Well, tonight we're returning to our series on Jesus' parables of the kingdom, as found in Matthew chapter 13. And we will read the next section of Matthew chapter 13, starting from verse 31. So Matthew chapter 13, reading from verse 31. He, that's Jesus, put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it's grown, it's larger than all the garden plants, and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." He told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman took and hid in three measures of flour till it was all leavened." All these things Jesus said to the crowds in parables. Indeed, he said nothing to them without a parable. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet: "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter what has been hidden since the foundation of the world." Well, you remember, I hope, the scene. Jesus is sitting in a boat on the lake, and he's speaking parables to the crowds who are gathered on the shore of the lake. And Matthew tells us there in verse 34 that on at least on this occasion, Jesus is only speaking to the crowds in parables. And we thought about the reason for that in an earlier sermon. The crowds have heard Jesus many times before. They've heard his teaching, and they've had every opportunity to listen to what he said and to repent, to enter his kingdom. But they've refused to do that. They've not done that openly like their leaders who are plotting to kill Jesus. But fundamentally, these people don't want what Jesus is teaching them. They like to hear his preaching, perhaps. They like to see his miracles. That's entertaining. Some of them perhaps are hoping that Jesus is going to lead a revolt against the Romans. They'd be happy if he did that. But they don't want to repent. They don't want to obey him. They don't want to have him as that kind of king. And Jesus, therefore, speaks to them in parables. And we saw that that's an act of judgment against these people. They're no longer clearly hearing God's words. As they listen to these words, they're only going to harden them unless they humble themselves to ask what the parables mean, unless they come to Jesus. And so these parables are having the effect of dividing the people who are there. On the one hand, you've got the crowds who won't listen, who don't know what the parables mean. And on the other hand, you have Jesus' disciples, the ones who are told are being taught the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. And as they hear these parables, and as how they have things explained to them, they are beginning to understand things about God's kingdom that no one has ever understood before. But now in verse 35, Matthew, the writer of this gospel, adds another explanation of what's happening. And he quotes from Psalm 78, the psalm that we read earlier. And he says this, he says that Jesus' words here are fulfilling the words spoken by that prophet, by the psalmist. Now, some people get very confused by these words here that Matthew's put into his gospel. They say, well, that psalmist isn't really speaking in parables. They say, well, hasn't Matthew just plucked this out and put it in here? It's not really connected to what Jesus is doing. Why has he used this quote here in Matthew? Well, remember what the word fulfill means. Stephen talked about this just a few weeks ago. The word fulfill, especially in Matthew's gospel, means to bringing out the full meaning, completing the picture. Something's happened in the Old Testament, and it's I think Stephen used the illustration of just a pencil drawing, and then you come to the New Testament, and all the colour is filled in. The full meaning is being drawn out for us. So we need to understand how here Jesus teaching these parables is fulfilling the pattern that's seen less clearly back in Psalm 78. And so we have to think a little bit about that psalm. Because when Matthew quotes this psalm, he's not interested in just those verses he's written down. He wants us to be thinking about that whole psalm and what it was there for in the Old Testament. Well, we read it together, so you know what that psalm is about. It's a review of the history of Israel. The things that we know because we've read the Old Testament. We know where those events come from. But he's telling that history with a particular purpose. He's not telling it to the Israelites to teach them a history lesson. It's things they already know. The psalmist says that. He says, these are the things that our fathers taught us. These are the things that we teach to our children. But the psalmist says, there's a parable here. There's a secret. There's something that you've not understood about your history. And I'm going to explain it to you. And that's what he's doing. And the big point that the psalmist is making is that the Israelites have failed God, that they've been stubborn and rebellious, that they've forgotten him and rebelled against him, even though he performed such mighty deeds on their behalf. They've still sinned against him and turned to idols. We read that again and again, didn't we, as we went through the psalm. But they rebelled against him. They rebelled against him. And special blame on that in that psalm is put on the leaders of Israel, the Ephraimites. Now, since the early days of Israel, since the days when Joseph was the prime minister in Egypt and brought his family down to him, Joseph had been the leading tribe in Israel, and especially the half-tribe of Ephraim. You'll remember Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and each of those two sons became a tribe in its own right. The man who led Israel into the promised land, Joshua, was from the tribe of Ephraim. And when the people got to the promised land, the tabernacle was pitched in the land belonging to the tribe of Ephraim, in a place called Shiloh. Deborah, one of the judges, came from Ephraim. And if you read through the book of Judges, you'll see that the Ephraimites thought they were in charge. If anyone who's not from their tribe, like Gideon or Jephthah, takes the lead, they instantly want to fight against him. They assume that they're the ones in charge. Even the prophet Samuel grew up in Ephraim and lived there. So all the leadership in Israel has been focused in that one tribe. But now the psalmist says that tribe, the leadership of Israel has failed. They've led Israel into sin. They failed to drive out the Canaanites. They've led the people into worshipping idols. And because of that, Israel has been rejected. and the tabernacle, God's dwelling place in Shiloh, has been forsaken. The particular historical occasion I think that the psalmist is talking about would be the defeats at the hand of Philistines, where you remember Eli's sons, the priests of Israel, were killed, and the ark of God was lost. As the psalm says, the priesthood were put to the sword. That's where Israel's leadership had taken them. But then, says the psalmist, then the Lord awoke. It's as if till this point the Lord's been asleep. But now he awakes and he takes action. And he saves his people. And how does he do it? Not by choosing a new judge from the tribe of Ephraim, but by establishing a kingdom. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loves. He builds a new sanctuary on Mount Zion. And he chooses a new king, David. And Israel's hope from that point is going to come from that king, from David. God's king reigning on God's behalf. That's the parable that the psalmist is explaining. He's saying that's history. That's the way you're meant to understand your history. And it's meant to make you trust in God as you trust in the king and the kingdom that he's set up. Well, now do you see how that, why Matthew refers back to Psalm 78? What's Jesus doing here as he tells these parables of the kingdom? Well, he's telling the crowds in parables that Israel's only hope is in the new kingdom that God is now establishing, and with David's son as the king. And Israel's only hope is going to come from that king, God's king reigning on God's behalf. Now, that makes Jesus' words so serious. Because if that's true, what's the implication for the Israelites? If this Old Testament pattern is now being fulfilled in Jesus' day, it's saying this. It's saying that Jesus' listeners are a stubborn and rebellious generation who've sinned against God and have been rejected by him. It says that their leaders are being rejected by God because they've led the people into sin. It means that God is going to reject the sanctuary, the temple, that's now the temple on Zion, and he's going to establish a new sanctuary. And the only hope of people in Israel is to entrust themselves to the true king, to the new kingdom that's being set up. Matthew wants us to realize that these parables aren't just nice stories. They're not just there to entertain the crowds. No, he's shouting to us. He's saying the only hope you have, you Israelites, is to understand what Jesus is saying. To understand these parables. You've got to know how to be part of the kingdom that Jesus is declaring to you. He's saying these are desperately important things to understand. That psalm, that man who spoke the psalm in his day, was God's spokesman to the people of Israel. Well, there's a greater spokesman here. This is God's great prophet, the one who's speaking ultimately for God. And he's warning them that the only hope that they have is to come into his kingdom and trust God's king. Matthew is saying it's desperately important that we understand these words. He's saying you've got to understand what they mean, or you're not going to be saved. You're not going to be part of God's kingdom. So what is it that Israel need to understand? What is it that we need to understand? Well, we started talking about this already as we've looked at some of the other parables. Do you remember what the Jewish people were expecting? They were expecting God's King, the Messiah, to come. But they were expecting him to come in power, to break into history and immediately defeat all evil, to defeat their enemies, to reign over the whole world from Jerusalem. They thought that his coming was going to be a great explosion, a mighty triumph, and it would be visible to the whole world, and everything would happen at once. And although their hope and expectation were right, that is going to happen one day, they were wrong in their understanding of God's timing. Those events are the things at the end of the story. That's where the kingdom's going to. But that's not how the kingdom begins. That's not how it's happening now at this point in history. So Jesus' task here, the parables he's telling, are to correct those misunderstandings. It's to show people how God's kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, is actually going to operate. He's telling them what they should expect. And of course, if God's kingdom comes in a very different way from the way that everyone is expecting, then all those people are in great danger, aren't they? They're in danger of not recognizing God's kingdom when it comes. God's kingdom has come. God's king is here. He's standing in front of them. But unless these people understand the parables, they're not going to believe it. They won't know that it's true. They're in danger of missing out on the kingdom altogether. Well, so far we've thought about two parables that correct two big misunderstandings. And the first misunderstanding number one was this. The Jewish people thought that the whole Jewish nation would be saved and brought into Messiah's kingdom. And Jesus has said to them, no, that's not the case. The only people who'll be saved, who'll be part of my kingdom, are those who hear and understand my message, the words of the kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is actually going to divide the nation. That was the secret of the parable of the sower. And so it's important for the crowds to understand that, isn't it? Because if they don't understand that, they're in danger of not being saved, of missing out on God's kingdom. The second misunderstanding number two, was this. That God's kingdom was going to come immediately and completely. And that all God's enemies would be defeated and evil would be banished for good straight away. And again, Jesus has to say, no, that's not the way it's going to be. Yes, the kingdom has come, but God's people, the sons of the kingdom, are going to have to live alongside their enemies, the sons of the evil one. It's going to be for a long time. Won't be forever, but it will be till the end of the age. That was the secret that was being taught in the parable of the weeds of the field. And again, if people don't understand this, then people are going to be in danger. Because the kingdom, God's kingdom, isn't going to look the way that they expect. God's work isn't going to look like God's work to them. Well, then Jesus goes on to tell them two more parables. And those are those two parables that we've read together this evening. And the first of those is the one that we often call the parable of the mustard seed. And we read it before. Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, a tiny seed, which a man plants in his garden. And it grows into a big plant. In fact, it grows into a tree. Well, what misunderstanding is that parable meant to correct? Well, all Jewish people knew that God's kingdom was going to be a worldwide, eternal kingdom. We read about that kingdom earlier in the book of Daniel at the beginning of the service. We read about how Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, he was the emperor of Babylon, which was the great world empire in Daniel's day. And that kingdom was described as a great tree. A tree in which the birds, people from all nations, would come and perch. And a very similar description is found, say, in Ezekiel chapter 31 of the Assyrian Empire. So this picture of great empires as trees is one that the Jewish people will be familiar with. But Nebuchadnezzar himself acknowledges that God's kingdom far surpasses his own. These are Nebuchadnezzar's words. His dominion, God's dominion, is an everlasting dominion. And his kingdom endures from generation to generation. So people read passages like that in the Old Testament, and they said, we can see God's kingdom is going to be a worldwide kingdom. It's going to be an everlasting kingdom. Well, Jesus agrees with those people because he identifies the kingdom of heaven with that great tree, that eternal, everlasting kingdom. Now, as he tells these parables, he calls himself the Son of Man. Do you remember in the book of Daniel, that was the name of the one to whom the kingdom was given, the king to whom the kingdom was given. So Jesus is saying, I am the king of that great kingdom. But now comes the surprise. And it's this. That vast eternal kingdom is going to start small. In fact, tiny, just like a grain of mustard seed. A small speck in a man's hand. You'd hardly be able to see it. Well, that's a picture everyone in the crowd would be able to understand. They'd all seen mustard seeds. And they'd all seen those seeds planted. And they'd all seen the plants, the big plants that such a seed would grow into. And they could see that there's a huge contrast between the two, the tiny seed and the great plant. And in fact, in the parable, Jesus exaggerates that contrast to make it even more remarkable. Ordinarily, a mustard plant might reach to a height of about 3 meters. But in Jesus' parable, that seed produces a tree. And by implication, that's a tree that touches heaven. So this is no ordinary seed, is it? So this would have been a great surprise to people. The kingdom, God's kingdom, is not going to be a worldwide kingdom straight away. It's going to start small. At this moment in time, it's just Jesus and his disciples. And in Jesus' day, at most, it was a few hundred people just in one small region of the Roman Empire. It's a tiny seed. But one day, it will be that huge world empire. And like a seed, it's going to have to grow. It's not going to be immediate. There's going to be a process that takes time to go from being the tiny seed to that great empire. And if the crowds don't understand that, again, it's going to be fatal for them. Because when they see this small beginning, they won't see that it's God at work. They won't realize that this is God's kingdom. They'll dismiss it. So that was the parable of the mustard seed. But then Jesus tells another parable, an even shorter one, sometimes called the parable of the leaven. And leaven is just yeast. and yeast. Most of you know, in case you don't, especially for the younger ones, it's what you put in bread, a bread mixture. You mix yeast in it and it produces little bubbles and it makes the bread rise. Otherwise you get very flat, not very nice bread. But when you put the loaf of bread that you eat at home, it's full of bubbles. It rises up before you cook it. Well, that's done by the yeast. And again, that parable that Jesus tells is addressing a misunderstanding. Everyone thought that God's kingdom, the coming of God's kingdom, was going to be something very visible and very obvious. They thought there were going to be great battles. You can't really miss a battle, can you? They thought that the victorious king would ride into Jerusalem and sit on a throne, reigning over the whole world. They thought that the peoples would be coming from every nation and bowing down in front of him and bringing tributes, just like happened in Solomon's day. They thought that Jerusalem was going to be a city with pavements of silver and awash with gold. They thought no one's going to be able to miss it. It's going to be obvious, visible, breathtaking in splendor and glory. That's what they thought the kingdom was going to be like. And once again, Jesus has to say to them, no, it's not going to be like that. At least, not yet. And that's the secret found in this parable. Actually, the kingdom of heaven is going to be like a woman making bread. What does she do? She mixes the yeast into the dough and she leaves it to rise. And slowly, invisibly, the yeast starts to do its work. Little gas bubbles start to seep into the dough and are trapped. And the bread imperceptibly starts to rise. And the point of that is it's hidden, it's invisible. If you sit and stare at a batch of dough that's waiting to go into the oven, it's not a very interesting thing to look at. It's going to be a very boring thing to do, to sit and watch it. It's just the same as if you sat and looked at a mustard seed growing. You quickly get very bored. Or if you watch paint drying, there's nothing to see. Now, maybe if you go away for an hour and come back, then you'll be able to see the difference. Then you'll be able to see how much bigger the loaf is. There is something going on. There's something real going on. But it takes time to see what's happening. Well, Jesus says, that's the kingdom of heaven. He says, it's not going to be spectacular and obvious and visible all the time. So much of the work of the kingdom is going to be hidden, out of sight, slow, invisible. He's not saying that it's going to be small and ineffective. In fact, the opposite. Again, Jesus uses a deliberate exaggeration to make his point. The woman pictured here isn't an ordinary housewife cooking for her family. Three measures of flour would have actually made bread for 100 men to sit down and eat. So we're not supposed to get the idea that this invisible work is small or insignificant. It's not, it's huge. But the kingdom's going to come in unexpected ways. And that's going to make it so easy for people not to recognize it. Invisible working is not the way that most people think that God works. Let's just stop for a minute and think about these four parables. We're not supposed to think of them as four completely separate stories. Jesus himself has deliberately connected them together, hasn't he? In three of them, we have a sower and a seed and a field and a crop growing. And in the fourth, we have the result of a crop of grain. We have a loaf of bread being made. Jesus wants us to put together those ideas to build up a picture of what the kingdom of heaven is like. So what is it like? It's going to be a tiny beginning. It's going to be seeds taking root in the hearts of some individuals and not others. There's going to be gradual growth. It's often going to be invisible. It's going to be something that's developing alongside wicked people. But yet it's spreading into the whole world. It's permeating the whole world. It's eventually becoming a huge tree. That's the picture we're being given. That's how God's planned it. That's what Jesus, the King, wants us to understand. And that's the reason why so many people, like these crowds, fail to recognize God's work. That's why so many people despise Christians and Christianity. They look at us, they look at the church, and they don't understand it. Because they don't know how God works here in the world. They don't know how God has planned to work here in the world. They don't know what God said he's going to do. And that's what Matthew is shouting to us, isn't he? He's saying, you need to understand. Unless you understand this, it could keep you from God's kingdom. I mean, maybe some of you here tonight who aren't Christians, you're not really sure about Christianity. And part of why you're not sure is you look around and you look at us. And you say, well, this church doesn't actually seem very spectacular. This isn't a very big church. It's not very impressive. I can't see God. I can't hear God. Can this, what's happening here tonight, really be the infinite God at work? Shouldn't I be looking for something bigger and better and more spectacular, more impressive? Well, the answer is you need to look to see if what Jesus said would happen is happening. Stop and ask yourself what you should expect to see from Jesus' words here. What should we expect to see in terms of immediate short-term progress and development? In terms of God's kingdom? What would he say? If you sit and watch bread rise, will you necessarily see anything? If you crouch in the garden waiting for a plant to come up, you'll quickly give up in despair. If you just look at the here and now on a small scale, on the way that people feel today, on the sins and mistakes that we've made this week, we'll get depressed. We'll think that God's not working. What we need to do is step back and look on that bigger scale, on that wider field of view. That's the only way to see if Jesus' words are true or not. So let's do that for a moment. Think about the Church of Christ compared to 2,000 years ago. What's happened? Well, that handful of disciples, that tiny seed, has become an army of millions of followers of Jesus Christ. You know, there are more sons of the kingdom, there are more Christians alive in the world today than there were people living on the earth in Jesus' day. That seed that was planted in a single nation has become a church which is in nearly every country of this world. In that time, world empires have come and they've gone, but the kingdom of heaven is growing into that tree. I think on a shorter scale, 200 years ago, Christianity was largely confined to Europe and America. And now it's spread into almost all of Africa, South America, and Asia. 70 years ago, it had gained a bare foothold in China. And now, after years of communist rule, there are tens of millions of followers of Christ's people in that country. 25 years ago, there were no churches in Albania. Today, churches are growing and being built in those countries and in the other countries of Eastern Europe. 30 years ago, there wasn't a church here in Stockport. There was just the beginnings of one. 30 years later, it might not be a big church, but it's bigger than the seed that was planted then. If you're somebody wondering whether you can believe the Christian message, whether you can trust it, look at that big picture. Can you see changed people? Can you see people who are different from how they were 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Can you see a changed world? Can you see nations which have been influenced by Christianity and changed? Can you see a church that started small and is growing big? Well, if so, then you can trust Jesus' words. Even if the place that you're sitting in at the moment seems small and unimportant and unimpressive, that's what you should expect. That's what Jesus said would happen. But it's not just unbelievers, is it, who have these kind of doubts? If you're a Christian, I'm sure you feel at times that as individual believers or as a church, we don't feel like we're achieving very much. We feel like our efforts are weak and useless. Sometimes we feel that no one listens to our words, that we're being ignored. Sometimes it feels like our prayers don't work. It feels like we're not achieving anything. It doesn't feel like the kingdom's growing, does it? Do you feel depressed that you're making such small progress as a Christian? Do you feel depressed that you can't see that you're making much progress? Are you still struggling with the same sins? Well, we need to do the same thing. We need to grab hold of that bigger picture, that wide perspective. Perhaps I can't see today how my struggles to pray have advanced God's kingdom. That doesn't mean the yeast isn't bubbling. Perhaps I can't see how my trying to concentrate and understand today's sermons is going to lead to God's glory. But the seed's taking a little water into it. Maybe I'm depressed that I lost my temper with my husband or my wife. But I've apologized and repented. But it feels like a backward step. But the grain is invisibly pushing upwards. Maybe I feel like my attempts to consistently discipline my children don't seem to be having an effect. But every time you do that, they're still being taught something of God's character. God's kingdom is coming. Sometimes it can be very slow and very difficult to see. But then there are times when we suddenly see the results of the invisible. It's as if we've come back to the dough 2 hours later and we suddenly realise that it is bigger than it was before. Perhaps you notice that at a baptismal service and you realise that God has been working in the heart of that person. Maybe for 10 years or 20 years or 40 years or perhaps for several generations to bring us to that day. Perhaps you read a passage of scripture that you've never understood before and suddenly it makes sense to you and you realise that there has been a change. Perhaps you've been praying for a member of your family for years and they've never shown any interest and then one day they want to come to church. Maybe you look at your child and you realise that the bad habit that you struggled so hard to combat has been gone for 6 months. There are those moments when we see that there has been progress, that has been change. The fact is that feeling weak and small or struggling and ineffective, either in our individual walks with God or as at a church, they're not signs that God isn't working. Very often God's work is like that. Let's thank God it's not always like that. Thank God that sometimes God's work does seem to become very visible and obvious for a time. There were days when 3,000 people were added to the church in Jerusalem. There were days when crowds wept at the words of a Whitfield or a Wesley. There were days when communism collapses in Albania. But equally, we don't need to despair, do we? When the Jerusalem church is scattered by persecution, or when a revival ends, that doesn't mean that God's kingdom has stopped working. So if we're Christians, these parables teach us not to despair when things seem hard and slow and painful. They teach us to keep going through persecution and trial. And they teach us not to set too great a store on the remarkable times. Yep, let's rejoice at times of revival. But let's assume that that's the norm in God's kingdom. But we do need to step back and look at the big picture. We do need to see what God is doing overall. God's kingdom is coming, just as Jesus said it would. You know, we have a great advantage over the disciples. The disciples only got to see the seed, the tiny seed. Well, we're living at a point in history where we see the tree. Maybe it's not quite fully grown yet, but we see a vast tree, don't we? We see Jesus' words have come true in a remarkable way. We can see more clearly than the disciples did that Jesus was right. And that should give us great confidence in walking with him, in trusting him, in serving him, even when things seem dark and difficult.